Those in touch with our world are the immediate agents for the carrying out of the law of karma, especially in connection with changes of land and sea brought about by earthquakes, tidal waves, and all other seismic causes. Rupa Devas, the beings known to the Hindus and Buddhists as Devas, to Zoroastrians as the lords of the heavenly and the earthly, to the Christians and Mohammedans as angels, and elsewhere as sons of God, etc., are a kingdom of spirits belonging to an evolution distinct from that of humanity, an evolution in which they may be regarded as a kingdom next above humanity, much as humanity is next above the animal kingdom. There is here, however, an important difference, for, whilst an animal can pass only into the human kingdom, a human being, when he attains the Asaka level, has several choices, of which the Deva line is one. Although connected with the earth, Devas are by no means confined to it, for the whole of our chain of seven worlds is as one world to them, their evolution being through a grand system of seven chains. Their hosts have hitherto been recruited chiefly from other humanities in the solar system, some lower and some higher than ours, since but a very small portion of our own is sufficiently advanced to be able to join them. It seems certain that some of their very numerous classes have not passed through any humanity at all comparable with ours. It is at present not possible for us to understand very much about them, but it is clear that the aim of their evolution is considerably higher than ours, that is to say, while the level of the Asaka adept is that at which we are aiming at the end of the seventh round, the level attained by the Deva evolution in the corresponding period will be a very much higher one for them. As for us, there is a steeper, but shorter path leading to still more sublime heights. There are at least as many types of angels or devas as there are races of men, and in each type there are many grades of power, of intellect, and of general development, so that altogether there are hundreds of varieties. Angels have been divided into nine orders, the names used in the Christian Church being angels, archangels, thrones, dominations, princedoms, virtues, powers, cherubim and seraphim. Of these, seven belong to the great rays of which the solar system is composed, and two may be called cosmic, as they are common to some other systems. In each order there are many types, in each there are some who work, some who assist those in trouble and sorrow, others who work among the vast hosts of the dead, some who guard, some who meditate, while others are at the stage where they are mainly concerned with their own development. There are also angels of music, who express themselves in music as we express ourselves in words. To them an arpeggio is a greeting, a fuga conversation, an oratorio an oration. There are angels of color, who express themselves by kaleidoscopic changes of glowing hues. There are also angels who live in and express themselves by perfumes and fragrances. A subdivision of this type includes the angels of incense, who are drawn by its vibrations and find pleasure in utilizing its possibilities. There is still another kind, belonging to the kingdom of nature spirits or elves, who do not express themselves by means of perfumes, but who live by and on such emanations and so are always found where fragrance is disseminated. There are many varieties, some feeding upon coarse and loathsome odors, and others only upon those which are delicate and refined. Amongst these are a few types who are especially attracted by the smell of incense, and who are therefore to be found in churches where incense is used. Those who have been taught to know and respond to the ancient call at the preface of the Christian Eucharist and who are charged with the distribution of the force, are often called the apostolic or messenger angels. Some of these are thoroughly conversant with this class of work, from long practice. Others are novices, eagerly learning what has to be done, and how to do it. The method of angelic evolution being largely by service, a ceremony such as the Eucharist offers them a remarkably good opportunity, of which they readily avail themselves. At a low celebration, the directing angel first responds to the call sent out by the priest, and he seems to assemble the rest. At a high celebration or missa cantata, the ancient melody attracts the notice of all immediately that it rings out, and they stand ready to attend at the appropriate time for each. The service rendered by the angels is of very many kinds, only a few bringing them into contact with human beings, mainly in connection with religious ceremonies. The angels invoked in the Christian services are far above men in spiritual development. In Freemasonry also angelic aid is invoked, but those called upon are nearer to the level of men in development and intelligence, and each of them brings with him a number of subordinates, who carry out his directions. Every regularly constituted Masonic lodge is in charge of a seventh-ray angel, who directs its affairs. None of the devas have physical bodies such as we have. The lowest kind are called Kama devas, who have as their lowest body the astral. The next class is that of the Rupa devas, who have bodies of lower mental matter, and who have their habitat on the four lower, or Rupa levels of the mental plane. The third class is that of the Arupa devas, who live in bodies of higher mental or causal matter. Above these there are four other great classes, inhabiting respectively the four higher planes of our solar system. Above and beyond the Deva kingdom altogether stand the great hosts of planetary spirits. In this book we are concerned, of course principally with the Rupa Devas. The relationship of Devas to nature spirits somewhat resembles, at a higher level, that of man to animals. Just as an animal can attain individualization only by association with man, so it seems that a nature spirit can normally acquire a permanent reincarnating individuality only by an attachment of a somewhat similar character to Devas. Devas will never be human, most of them already beyond that stage, but there are some who have been human beings in the past. The bodies of Devas are more fluidic than those of men, being capable of far greater expansion and contraction. They have also a certain fiery quality which clearly distinguishes them from human beings. The fluctuations in the aura of a Deva are so great that, for example, the aura of one which was normally about 150 yards in diameter has been observed to expand to about 2 miles in diameter. The colors in the aura of a Deva are more of the nature of flame than of cloud. A man looks like an exceedingly brilliant, yet delicate cloud of glowing gas, but a Deva looks like a mass of fire. Devas live far more in the circumference, more all over their auras than a man does. Whilst 99% of the matter of a man's aura is within the periphery of his physical body, the proportion is far less in the case of a Deva. They usually appear as human beings of gigantic size. They possess vast knowledge, great power, and are most splendid in appearance. They are described as radiant, flashing creatures, myriad-hued, like rainbows of changing supernal colors, of stateliest imperial mien. Calm energy incarnate, embodiments of resistless strength. In Revelation, X, 1, one of them is described as having a rainbow upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. As the sound of many waters are their voices. They guide natural order, their cohorts carrying on ceaselessly the process of nature, with regularity and accuracy. Devas produce thought forms as we do, but theirs are usually not so concrete as ours, until they reach a high level. They have a wide generalizing nature, and are constantly making gorgeous plans. They have a color language, which is probably not as definite as our speech, though in certain ways it may express more. The initiations which we take are not taken by Devas, their kingdom and ours converge at a point higher than the adept. There are ways in which a man can enter the Deva evolution, even at our stage, or lower. The acceptance of this line of evolution is sometimes spoken of, in comparison with the sublime renunciation of the Noumenachians, as yielding to the temptation to become a god. But it must not be inferred from this expression that any shadow of blame attaches to the man who makes this choice. The path which he selects is not the shortest, but it is a very noble one, and if his developed intuition impels him toward it, it is certainly the one best suited to his capacities. In Freemasonry the Deva captain associated with the SD is a Rupa Deva, and he employs nature spirits and elemental essence at his own level. The Deva captains corresponding to the three principal officers are Arupa Devas, who possess the consciousness and wield the forces of the planes which they respectively represent. The Deva of the JW takes charge of the first degree, the Deva of the SW of the second degree, and the Deva of WM of the third degree. Nothing is known of any rule or limit for the work of the Devas. They have more lines of activity than we can imagine. They are usually quite willing to expound and exemplify subjects along their own line to any human being who is sufficiently developed to appreciate them. Much instruction is given in this way, but few are able to profit by it as yet. Whilst devas are exceedingly beautiful, the lower orders of them have the vaguest and cloudiest conceptions of things, being inaccurate so far as facts are concerned. Hence, while a deva friend may be an exceedingly interesting person, yet, having no relation to the facts amidst which humanity is evolving, the greatest care should be exercised in following advice he may give as to physical actions. In general, the higher order of devas unreservedly cooperate with the great plan of the universe, hence the perfect order that we find in nature. In the lower ranks, this perfect obedience is instinctive and automatic, rather than conscious. They do their work, feeling impelled in the direction of the one will which runs through everything. In the case of national devas, whilst the one at the head of each nation is a being of lofty intelligence, who always cooperates with the plan, the lower national devas are found fighting, for example, for their own nation on a battlefield. As their intelligence develops, they cooperate more and more with the plan. The spirit of the earth, that obscure being who has the earth for his body, is not of the highest order of devas. Little is known of him. He may be said to belong more to the Rupa devas, because he has the earth for his body. Devas who are beyond the level of the Aseka adept, that is, that of the fifth initiation, normally live in what is called in Sanskrit the Jnanadiha, or the body of knowledge. The lowest part of that body is an atom of the nirvanic plane, serving them as our physical body serves us. For a description of the four devarajas, or regents of the earth, the student is referred to the astral body, p. 187. In Freemasonry, the four tassels which appear in the corners of the indented border symbolize the devarajas, the rulers of the elements of earth, water, air and fire, and the agents of the law of karma. Animal group souls. The group souls, to which the vast majority of animals are attached, are found on the lower mental plane. It would take us too far afield to describe the nature of these group souls, so we confine ourselves merely to mentioning them here. Individualized animals. These, together with their state of consciousness on the mental plane, have already been described on p. 204. Second elemental kingdom. We have already, in chapter 2, described the genesis of the mental elemental essence. We have also dealt with this essence in its function as part of man's mental body, and also as used in thought forms. Little more, therefore, need be said about it here. There are three elemental kingdoms, the first in soul's matter of the higher mental or causal sub-planes, the second, the matter of the four lower levels of the mental plane, the third, astral matter. In the second kingdom, the highest subdivision exists on the fourth sub-plane, whilst there are two classes on each of the three lower sub-planes, thus making in all seven subdivisions on these four sub-planes. We have already seen, p.5, that the mental essence is on the downward arc of evolution, and therefore is less evolved than astral essence or, of course, than any of the later kingdoms, such as the mineral, and we have also emphasized the importance of this fact, which the student should bear constantly in mind. Mental essence is, if possible, even more instantaneously sensitive to thought action than is the astral essence. The wonderful delicacy with which it responds to the faintest action of the mind being constantly and prominently brought to the notice of investigators. It is, of course, in this response that its very life consists, its progress being helped by the use of it by thinking entities. If it could be imagined as entirely free for a moment from the action of thought, it would appear as a formless conglomeration of dancing infinitesimal atoms, instinct with marvelous intensity of life, but probably making but little progress on the downward path of evolution into matter. But when thought seizes upon it, and stirs it into activity, throwing it on the rupa levels into all kinds of lovely forms, and on the arupa levels into flashing streams, it receives a distinct additional impulse which, often repeated, helps it forward on its way. For when a thought is directed from higher levels to the affairs of earth, it sweeps downwards and takes upon itself the matter of the lower planes. In doing this, It brings the elemental essence, of which the first veil was formed, into contact with the lower matter, thus by degrees the essence becomes accustomed to answer to lower vibrations, and so progresses in its downward evolution into matter. The essence is also very noticeably affected by music, poured forth by great musicians in Devachan, cp. 197. It should be clearly recognized that there is a vast difference between the grandeur and power of thought on its own plane and the comparatively feeble effort we know as thought on the physical plane. Ordinary thought originates in the mental body and, as it descends, clothes itself in astral essence. A man who can use his causal body generates his thoughts at that level. These thoughts clothe themselves in lower mental essence, and are consequently infinitely finer, more penetrating, and in every way more effective. If the thought be directed exclusively to higher objects, its vibrations may be too fine to find expression in astral matter, but when they do affect this lower matter they have far greater effect than those generated so much nearer to the level of that lower matter. Following the idea further, the thought of an initiate takes rise on the buddhic plane, and clothes itself in causal matter, the thought of a master takes its rise on the plane of Atma, wielding the incalculable powers of regions of matter beyond our ordinary ken. Artificial elementals. Mental elementals, or thought forms, having already been fully described, little further need be said about them. The mental plane is even more fully peopled by artificial elementals than is the astral plane, and they play a large part among the living creatures that function on the mental plane. They are, of course, more radiant and the more brilliantly colored than our astral elementals, are stronger, more lasting, and more fully vitalized. When it is also remembered how much grander and more powerful thought is on the mental plane, and that its forces are being wielded not only by human entities, but by devas, and by visitors from higher planes, it will be realized that the importance and influence of such artificial entities can scarcely be exaggerated. Great use is made of these mental elementals by masters and initiates, the elementals which they create having, of course, a much longer existence and proportionately greater power than any of those which were described in dealing with the astral plane, in the astral body, p. 190. Chapter 30. Death of the mental body. Life in Devachan, the heaven world, being, as we have seen, finite, must come to an end. This takes place when the ego has assimilated all the essence of the experiences which were gathered in the preceding physical and astral lives. All the mental faculties, which were expressed through the mental body, are then withdrawn within the higher mental or causal body. Together with them, the mental unit, which performs a function similar to that performed by the physical and astral permanent atoms, also is withdrawn within the causal body, and remains there in a latent condition until called forth into renewed activity, when the time comes for rebirth. The mental unit, together with the astral and physical permanent atoms, are enwrapped in the buddhic life web, cp. 285, and stored up as a radiant nucleus-like particle in the causal body, being all that remains to the ego of his bodies in the lower worlds. The mental body itself, the last of the temporary vestures of the true man, the ego, is left behind as a mental corpse, just as the physical and astral bodies were left behind. Its materials disintegrate, and return to the general matter of the mental plane. We are not, strictly, concerned in this volume with the life of the man on the higher mental or causal plane. But, in order not to leave the story of man's life between one incarnation and the next to incomplete, we may mention very briefly the portion of that life spent on the higher mental plane. Every human being, on his completion of his life on the astral and lower mental planes, obtains at least a flash of consciousness of the ego, in the causal body. The more developed, of course, have a definitely conscious period, living as the ego on its own plane. In the momentary flash of ego consciousness, the man sees his last life as a whole, and gathers from it the impression of success or failure in the work which it was meant to do. Together with this, he also has a forecast of the life before him, with the knowledge of the general lesson which that is to teach, or the specific progress which he is intended to make in it. Only very slowly does the ego awaken to the value of these glimpses, but when he comes to understand them, he naturally begins to make use of them. Eventually he arrives at a stage when this glimpse is no longer momentary, when he is able to consider the question much more fully, and to devote some time to his plans for the life which lies before him. Further description of the life of the ego on his own plane must now be deferred for the fourth volume of this series, which will deal with the causal body. Chapter 31: The Personality and Ego. We now come to consider the relationship between the personality and the ego. As, however, we have not yet studied the ego, this, of course, having to be reserved for our next volume on the causal body, it will not be possible for us to investigate the relationship between personality and ego quite fully. Furthermore, we must in this volume examine the question mainly from the point of view of the personality, rather than from that of the ego. In the causal body, we must again take up the subject, which is one of very great importance, but then, of course, principally from the point of view of the ego. The personality consists of the transitory vehicles through which the true man, the thinker, expresses himself in the physical, astral and lower mental worlds, that is, the physical, astral and lower mental bodies, and of all the activities connected with these vehicles. The individuality consists of the thinker himself, the self in the causal body. As a tree puts out leaves, to last through spring, summer and autumn, so does the individuality put out personalities to last through the life periods spent on the physical, astral and lower mental planes. Just as the leaves take in, assimilate, and pass on nutriment to the sap, which is eventually withdrawn into the parent trunk, and then fall and perish, so does the personality gather experience and pass it on to the parent individuality, eventually, when its task is completed, falling and perishing. The ego incarnates in a personality for the sake of acquiring definiteness. The ego on his own plane is magnificent, but vague in his magnificence, except in the case of men far advanced on the road of evolution. The principles of man are sometimes classified as follows: one, classification A, slightly different classification, the immortal triad or individuality, Atma, immortal Atma, Buddhi, Buddhi Manas, higher Manas, the perishable quaternary or personality, Karma, conditionally immortal, Karma Manas, Prana, mortal Prana, etheric, double dense body. A classification used by H. P. Blavatsky is as follows. She speaks of four divisions of the mind: 1, Manas Dajasi, the resplendent or illuminated manas, which is really buddhi, or at least that state of man when his manas has become merged in buddhi, having no separate will of its own. 2, manas proper, the higher manas, the abstract thinking mind. 3, antakarana, the link or bridge between higher manas and karma manas during incarnation. 4, karma manas, which on this theory is the personality. Sometimes she calls manas the deva ego, or the divine as distinguished from the personal self. Higher manas is divine because it has positive thought, which is kriya shakti, the power of doing things, all work being in reality done by thought power. The word divine comes from div, to shine, and refers to the divine quality of its own life which shines from within manas. The lower mind is merely a reflector, having no light of its own. It is something through which the light comes, or through which the sound comes, merely persona, a mask. Among the Vedantins, or in Sri Shankaracharya's school, the term antakarana, cp. 271, is used to indicate the mind in its fullest sense, meaning the entire internal organ or instrument between the innermost self and the outer world, and is always described as of four parts: 1, ahamkara, the I-maker; 2, buddhi, insight, intuition, or pure reason; 3, manas, thought; 4, chitta, discrimination of objects, what the Western man usually calls his mind, with its powers of concrete and abstract thought, is the last two in the above classification, viz., manas and chitta. The theosophist should recognize in the Vedantic divisions his own familiar Atma, buddhi, manas, and the lower mind. In the symbolism of Freemasonry, The lower mind and the mental body are represented by the SD. The following table sets out the principles of man in the system of Freemasonry: principles in man, officer, color of associated nature, Sanskrit, English, spirits and elemental essence, Atma, will, WM, rose, gold, blue and green, buddhi, intuition, SW, predominantly electric blue, higher manas, higher mind, JW, predominantly golden, lower manas, lower mind, SD, yellow, karma, desire and emotion, JD, crimson, linga, sharira, dense physical body, OG. Thus the higher triad or spiritual trinity, both in God and man, are represented in Freemasonry by the three principal officers, while the lower self, personality, or quaternary, is represented by the three assistant officers and the Tyler. In Christianity we find the following symbolism: : elements and vessels. In the Church Mass, principles in man, hos monad paten atma buddhi manas. Why an ego or individuality, chalice, causal body, water, personality. The taking on of a personality by the ego has also been likened to the projection of a spark from the flame of mind. The flame fires the material upon which it has fallen, and from that a new flame will arise, identical in its essence with that which generated it, but separated for purposes of manifestation. Hence it is said that you may light 1,000 candles from a single flame, but the flame is never diminished, although 1,000 flames are visible where only one was visible before. The thinker, the individuality, alone endures. He is the man for whom the hour never strikes, the eternal youth who, as the Bhagavad Gita expresses it, puts on and casts off bodies as a man puts on new garments and throws off the old. Each personality is a new part for the immortal actor, and he treads the stage of human life over and over again, but in the life drama each character he assumes is the child of the preceding ones, and the father of those to come, so that the life history is a continuous one. The elements of which the personality is composed are bound together by the links of memory caused by the impressions made on the three lower vehicles, and also by the self-identification of the thinker with his vehicles, which sets up the personal I consciousness known as Ahamkara, derived from Aham meaning I, and Kara meaning making. Ahamkara thus means the I maker. In the lower stages of evolution, this I consciousness is in the physical and astral vehicles, the greatest activity being in these bodies. Later it passes to the lower mental body, which then assumes predominance. The personality, with its transient feelings, desires, passions, thoughts, thus forms a quasi-independent entity, yet all the time it draws its energies from the thinker it enwraps. Moreover, as its qualifications, which belong to the lower worlds, are often in direct antagonism to the permanent interests of the individuality, the dweller in the body, conflict is set up, victory sometimes inclining to the temporary pleasure, sometime to the permanent gain. In dealing with the personality, the obstacle to be overcome is asmita, the notion that I am this, or what a master once called self-personality. The personality, as we have seen, develops through life into quite a definite thing, with decided physical, astral and mental form, occupation and habits. And there is no objection to that, if it be a good specimen. But if the indwelling life can be persuaded that he is that personality, he will begin to serve its interests, instead of using it merely as a tool for his spiritual purposes. Hence, in consequence of this error, we find men seeking inordinate wealth, power, fame, etc. Self-personality is the greatest obstacle to the use of the personality by the higher self, and so to spiritual progress. The life of a personality, of course, begins when the thinker forms a new mental body, see chapter 32, and it endures until that mental body disintegrates at the close of the period spent in Devachan. The objective of the ego is to unfold his latent powers, and this he does by putting himself down into successive personalities. Men who do not understand this, and they are, of course, at the present time the great majority of humanity, look upon the personality as the real self, and consequently live for it alone, regulating their lives for what appears to be its temporary advantage. The man, however, who understands, realizes that the only important thing is the life of the ego, and that its progress is the object for which the temporary personality must be used. Thus, when he has to decide between two possible courses of action, he does not, as most men do, consider which will bring him the greater pleasure or profit as a personality, but which will bring greater progress to him as an ego. Experience soon teaches him that nothing which is not good for all can ever be good for him, or for anyone. Thus he learns to forget himself altogether, and to consider only what is best for humanity as a whole. Intensification of the personality, at the expense of the ego, is an error against which the student should ever be on his guard. Consider, for example, the probable result of the very commonest of failing selfishness.